Blog Talk Radio.
Afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show, coming to you from our studios in exciting El Paso, Texas, gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, we've got a lot going on. I want to mention again, I had another talk with my cell phone carrier. And the new scam that's going around, for those of you that's not familiar with it, you'll get a call that appears to be coming from your cell carrier. And if it be a recording, that will say your account's being suspended for suspicious activity. Push 1 if you want to talk to an agent. So you push 1. And somebody comes on, says he's from the security department, and he tells you that someone has ordered 2 iPhone 10s to be delivered to them in Louisiana. Norman Williams is the name of the person that's conducted this fraud. And just to make sure they're talking to the right person, they're going to send you an 8-digit code for you to repeat back to them. Well, the 8-digit code comes, and it does come from whoever your carrier is. And you repeat it back. And then they'll say, well, that didn't come fast enough, so there may have been an issue, so they're going to do it again. And then you get another 8-digit code, and you repeat that back. And then they'll start talking to you, and they'll give you their name and their identification number. And in my case, halfway through the conversation, the call dropped. Now, the 8-digit code did come from the carrier. It was a temporary password that allowed them to log into my account. And what they do is they log in and they add themselves as another authorized user. Then they'll walk into one of the cell company stores and order half a dozen phones, charge to the account, and then they vanish. And you're left with the bill for a half dozen or so $1,000 telephones. Now, they don't want service. They want the equipment that they can sell. Well, in my particular case, I knew something was up when he gave me his last name, because they don't do that. Now, when the call came in, my phone identified it as coming from my carrier. They had used computer software to copy that number. So I called and explained the situation to the carrier's customer service, and they immediately checked to make sure that nothing had been done to my account. But had I not done that, I would today be explaining to my carrier that I didn't order those half dozen iPhone 10s. I had a friend of mine who works for that company call me today, and we went over everything, and he accessed my account and determined that nothing had been done. But he said he had seen a lot of accounts where that had taken place. They add their name on as an authorized user. Well, I have a business account, so it's a little different. Before anybody can be added to my account, I have to be called and I have to give permission. But with an individual account, that's not the case. It can all be done through the website with that temporary password. So if you get a call from your carrier, be suspicious. Well, tonight we're going to talk about ancient aliens. Now, there are very few people, regardless of their religious persuasion, haven't heard about the Ten Commandments, also referred to as the Decalogue. Essentially, they're purported to be strict laws prepared by the Christian God. Laws designed to ensure that humanity follows a good and righteous path. They were laid down on a pair of stone tablets that were given to Moses at Mount Sinai. Moses, of course, we discussed him in a previous show. He was an Egyptian prince, born a Hebrew. Raised as an Egyptian prince. Now, it's notable that midway through the 20th century, a number of people who claimed contact with extraterrestrials had experiences that paralleled the story of Moses receiving the commandments on Mount Sinai. Now, before we delve into that at some length, let's take a look at the story behind the Ten Commandments. Now, the story appears twice in the pages of the Bible, in Deuteronomy and in Exodus. Starts with the Israelites, variously referred to as the sons of Israel, the children of Israel, reaching Mount Sinai, also known as Mount Horeb. Stands at approximately 7,500 feet in the Egyptian Sinai Peninsula, located between the Red Sea and the Mediterranean. Of course, there is some discussion about whether or not this particular Mount Sinai and the Mount Sinai of the Old Testament are one and the same. There's evidence that it's not. And then we go to Exodus 19, and that's where, for all intents and purposes, the story begins. Approximately 72 hours after Moses and the Israelites arrived at the foot of the mountain, something strange happens. The air is filled with huge flashes of lightning. Thunder crashed. And then a thick cloud descended on Mount Sinai, and the voice of the trumpet echoed throughout the vicinity. Now, the people, of course, were a tad disturbed by all this. That cloud was the Lord coming down on Mount Sinai, after which Moses had a short discussion and came back with the tablets. Of course, the people were not exactly happy about all this, but he assured them everything was okay. The Old Testament states that following his reassurances, he walked toward that thick cloud, and listened carefully as the voice of God boomed and proceeded to lay down the law, so to speak. Following morning, Moses, along with Aaron, the high priest of Israel, and his sons, Nadab and Abihu, climbed Mount Sinai. They saw the God of Israel hovering above what was described as a paved work of sapphire. For no less than 6 days, according to the story, Mount Sinai was covered by that thick cloud. And on day 7, Moses entered the cloud and remained in the mount 40 days and 40 nights. You know, that time period was found in numerous times throughout the biblical stories. Well, while Moses was gone, the children of Israel decided to take matters into their own hands, which meant that they asked Aaron to create a deity in the form of a golden calf. And they built an altar. Then they had partying and orgies and everything that goes with worshiping an idol. At least till Moses got back when, if you pardon the expression, all hell broke loose. He had with him a pair of stone tablets that contained the Ten Commandments. But he was angry about the activities that went on in his absence. He smashed the tablets on the ground. Well, God, according to the Bible, saw that Moses' anger was aimed at his people, not at God, so he gave him 2 new tablets. And on those tablets, he wrote the 10 Commandments. The golden calf was destroyed, and the 10 Commandments became the law of the land. And supposedly, the 2 tablets were put into the Ark of the Covenant. And the rest is basically history. Now, the story of the Ten Commandments is one that millions of people believe to be, if you pardon the expression, the gospel truth. But there's an issue that needs to be addressed, and that places the story of the Ten Commandments into a very different context, the context of the UFO controversy. Now, if you've seen the news, because I have the app that gives me Fox News every day, the Pentagon has admitted that they are actually studying UFOs and have been since at least the 40s. Now, the matter of the flashing and booming in the sky and that curious black cloud that appeared out of nowhere, the disembodied voice of God, all led to theories that what Moses actually encountered are extraterrestrials aboard a huge, dark-colored spaceship that wished to try and civilize the human race by indoctrinating it with a rigid system of rules, regulations, and laws. Now, there are many people who are radically religious, I guess you could say, who are angered at such a scenario even being suggested. And the fact is that more than a few UFO encounters have had similar parallels with the biblical version of what happened. And it does raise the question. Now, let's start out with the man who absolutely typified the UFO scene in the 50s, George Adamski. Born in Poland, he moved to the U.S. with his parents when he was a child. Spent 4 years in the military at the height of the First World War, and then spent time working in a flour mill and in Yellowstone National Park. During his 30s, though, he began to gravitate toward the world of the unknown, of the paranormal, and finally, the world of the flying saucer. He received significant publicity in early 1934 when the LA Times profiled him in its pages, told of his relocation to California. And it took particular note of his words that revolved around a trek that he made to the Himalayas. Notably, Adamski, while high up in the mountains, had an experience that mirrored Moses' moment of enlightenment on Mount Sinai. According to the article, the 10-foot trumpets of the faraway Lhasa, perched among perpetual snows in the Himalayan mountains of Tibet, was sure to have their echo on the sedate hills of Southern California's Laguna Beach. Been there. That's a gorgeous place. Already, the Royal Order of Tibet has acquired acreage in the placid hills that bathe their sun-kissed feet in the purling Pacific. Before long, the walls, temples, and turrets and dungeons of a Lama monastery will serrate the skyline. It'll be the first Tibetan monastery in America. And, of course, a town to train disciples of the cult will filter through its glittering gates to spread the ancient truths among those who care to listen. And central to the new movement is George Adamski. And according to Adamski, I learned great truths up there on the roof of the world, or rather the trick of applying age-old knowledge to daily life to cure the body and the mind and win mastery over self and soul. I don't bring to Laguna the weird rites and bestial superstition in which the old Lamaism is steeped, but the scientific portions of the religion. Well, the Lagunans were not 100% receptive, so he wasn't long for Laguna Beach. He soon had another base of operations. Palomar Gardens, located near California's Palomar Mountain. And he opened a cafe. And in 1946, Adamski, the intelligence behind the UFO phenomenon, crossed paths in legendary fashion. In October of that year, Adamski and several of his friends and followers encountered a gigantic, unidentified flying object in the skies near the mountain, one that was long and pencil-shaped. A similar craft, or maybe the same one, appeared the following year, 1947, and yet again at the side of the huge mountain. It's 52, though, that really thrust Adamski into the ufology business big time. Greg Bishop, who has carefully studied the life and claims of Adamski, tells the story of what happened in an article titled Tracks in the Desert. It appeared in a 2000 book entitled Wake Up Down There. So Adamski left his Palomar Mountain retreat at 1 a.m. on Thursday, November 20th, 1952, along with his lifetime secretary, Lucy McGinnis, and Alice Wells, the owner of the property where Adamski gave lectures on universal law and the cafe where he flipped burgers to pay the rent. At about 8 a.m., they met with Al Bailey and his wife Betty and George Hunt Williamson and his wife Betty in Blythe, California, just west of the Arizona-California border. The group turned back when they all had what they described as a hunch. They retraced their steps, took a small highway 11 miles northeast toward Arizona, where they stopped. Had breakfast, and then they scanned the skies for flying saucers. Now, passing motorists slowed down, seeing a group of people looking up in the air, and around noon, an aircraft flew over the group. Shortly after that aircraft flew over, a huge silver-colored egg-shaped UFO suddenly appeared. Bishop said Williamson understatedly asked, is that a spaceship? As Betty Bailey tried to set up a movie camera but couldn't because she was so excited at what she was seeing. According to Adamski, they were anxious not to attract attention to the object, so they didn't point at it and alert other passing cars to this event. Adamski yelled, somebody take me down the road quick. That ship's come looking for me and I don't want to keep them waiting. So he jumped in the car with McGinnis and Mr. Bailey, and about half mile down the road with the craft flying above him, Adamski told McGinnis to turn off the road and told the other two to go back and join the ones that left behind and watch for anything that might take place from a safe viewing distance of a half mile. Well, this first craft was chased away by interceptor jets, but shortly another beautiful small craft arrived and landed behind the crest of a mountain about a half mile away. Adamski said he saw figure waving at him, and he walked toward it. He said, I realized I was in the presence of a man from space, a human being from another world. This individual identified himself as Orthon, and claimed to come from the planet Venus. After some warnings about atomic weapons and wars and the fact we should quit testing atomic weapons and refusal to be photographed, Orthon got back in his ship and flew off. According to Bishop, at that point, Adamski waved to his companions to approach, and when they did, Williamson brought along some plaster of Paris, proceeded to make casts of the footprints the Venusian had left in the desert. According to Williamson, he was the first to arrive at the footprints after the contact had been made. I could see where the space being had scraped away the topsoil in order to get more moist and sand that would take the impressions from the carvings on the bottom of his shoes. Now, the carvings on the bottom of the shoes must have been finely done for the impressions in the sand were clear cut. Well, either Orthon had a weight problem that pressed them into the sand unusually deep, or somebody taking extra care in making the impressions. Well, at this point, Bishop noted something that had a parallel with the saga of the Ten Commandments. He said Adamski went on to state his interpretation of what meaning the symbols hold for those who fail to obey the laws of the Infinite Father. Now, Williamson stressed the designs weren't alien since the Earth is part of the great totality and the ancient symbols of Earth are the symbols of the space beings as well. Well, after this event, Williamson found his calling, concentrated on turning out his own brand of contactee literature, most of it channeled. Leaving clear the nuts and bolts domain of his friend, George Adamski, Williamson went on to build quite a reputation and make a bucket of money with his contactee literature. Now, Adamski had set up his organization on a mountain, and he had several profound UFO encounters on that very same mountain, and all of this culminated in a statement that offered warnings to those who fail to obey the laws of the Infinite Father. It's a clear demonstration of the undeniable parallels between the story of the Ten Commandments and the saga of the most famous contactee of all. George Adamski was probably the best-known individual in the UFO field back in the 50s and 60s. A lot of people compared him to Moses. Now, there were others who experienced deeply similar encounters. Truman Bethurum was a Californian. Spent many of his early years working jobs that never seemed to last. First marriage began both and also crumbled during the Second World War. Entered into a second marriage several months after the war ended and ultimately wound up working out in the hot deserts of Nevada, specifically highway construction. And while he was out in the desert in 1952, and while his second wife, Mary, was stuck at home in Santa Barbara, that he claimed he had an extremely close encounter with extraterrestrials on Mormon Mesa. That's a 2,000-foot high mount in Nevada's Moapa Valley. On the night in question, after working day was over, he climbed the mountain primarily to search for shells, something that Mary enjoyed collecting. Story goes, he was rendered into a strange, altered state of mind during which advanced aliens suddenly manifested in front of him, having arrived in a huge, gleaming, flying saucer. And although they were only about 5 feet high, he said, the aliens were eerily human-looking and claimed to come from a faraway planet called Clarion. Not only that, their leader was a female by the name of Captain Aura Raines. An Pamela Anderson type who Bethurum described as being tops in shapeliness and beauty. In fact, he forgot all about Mary back in Santa Barbara. Not only did the Clarionites impart a great deal of data about their home world, their religion, and their belief in an all-powerful deity, they did something else, something that those of a Christian persuasion find all too familiar. They provided Bethurum with a gold plate that outlined the laws of the space people. So here we have another example of somebody taking a walk into the mountains, communing with superior entities, and being given a priceless honor effect that the detail the rules and regulations of the aliens. In that sense, there's very little difference between Moses' trek up Mount Sinai, where he communed with God and got the Ten Commandments, and Truman Bethuroon heading up to Mormon Mesa and being given a gold platter, courtesy of human-looking extraterrestrials who wanted to share their laws with the human race. Well, there was another parallel. In the same way that the God of the Old Testament is portrayed very much as a ruthless, cold-hearted deity, so the Clarionites were described as somewhat fascist, bullying types who insisted that Bethuroon help them spread their word. Or else. The wrath of God versus the wrath of the extraterrestrials. There's really not that much difference. Then there was George Van Tassel. Claimed interaction with aliens out in the harsh roasting desert near Joshua Tree, California in the early 50s. Just like the extraterrestrials that both George Adamski and Truman Bertharum claimed to have encountered in the very same time frame. Now, Van Tassel's visitors from the stars were extremely human-like and highly demanding when it came to getting across their space laws and regulations. At the time of the encounters, Van Tassel was living in the desert region of a small town called Landers. It was actually a large converted cave beneath a gigantic rock that was given the name Giant Rock. Claimed the aliens told him that the human race had been molded, guided, and manipulated for thousands of years by extraterrestrials that posed as gods. In that sense, God was nothing more than a fabrication, one that was created to ensure the people of Earth adhered to the word of the space aliens. And a lot of people were fascinated by his claims. He established a yearly UFO conference at Giant Rock that at its height in the mid-50s attracted tens of thousands. They came to hear him speak, to buy his literature. The word was spreading. Even the FBI got involved. Documentation declassified by the FBI demonstrates that Van Tassel was a keen interest to J. Edgar Hoover and his G-men, as were Van Tassel's statements about ancient aliens and the Ten Commandments. An FBI report on a lecture Van Tassel gave in Denver in 1960, titled Unidentified Flying Objects, and prepared by an FBI agent on April 26, 1960, said the major part of the lecture was devoted to explaining the occurrences in the Bible as they related to the space people. He said that the only mention of God in the Bible is in the beginning when the universe is being made. He said, after that, all references are to out of the sky or out of heaven. He said, this is due to the fact that man, space people, was made by God. And that in the beginning of the world, the space people came to the earth and left animals here. These are the prehistoric animals that existed at a body temperature of 105. But a polar tilt occurred where the pole shifted into tropical climates became covered with ice and vice versa. After the polar tilt, the temperature was to sustain life was 98.6, which was suitable for space people, so they established a colony and left only males here, intending to bring females at a later date on supply ships. This is reflected in Adam not having a wife initially. He said Adam wasn't an individual, but rather a race of men. Now, Van Tassel said this race was intermarried with intelligent, upright, walking animals, which race was Eve. Then when the space people came back in the supply ships, they saw what had happened and didn't land. And ever since, due to the origin of Adam, they've watched over the people of Earth. He said, this is in the Bible many times, such as Moses getting the Ten Commandments. He said, the Ten Commandments are the laws of the space people, and men on earth only give them lip service. And manna from heaven was bread supplied by the space people. He also stated this can be seen from the native story, such as the Indians in America saying that corn and potatoes, unknown in Europe, were brought here by a flaming canoe. He said, this can be shown also by the old stories of winged chariots and winged white horses, which came out of the sky. He said that Jesus was born of Mary, who was a space person sent here already pregnant in order to show the earth people the proper way to live. He said the space people have watched over us through the years and have tried to help us. They've sent their agents to Earth and they appear just as we do. And they have the power to know your thoughts just as Jesus did. He said this is their means of communication. And many of the space people are mute, but they train a certain number of them to speak Earth languages. While those who interpret the Bible literally will doubtless balk at the claims of George Van Tassel, Truman Bethurum, and George Adamski, the fact is all three were told stories that paralleled the biblical saga of the events at Mount Sinai to some cases, identical degrees. Someone or something for thousands of years has attempted to enforce its rules and regulations on the human race. Whether it was a god or all-powerful aliens from a far-off star system very much depends on one's personal belief system, which is the way things have pretty much always been. The George Adamski wrote at great length about his adventures with aliens. Van Tassel was probably, no one really knows how much he made from his giant rock events, but he did very well. And there were a number of contactees. Howard Menger, a painter who discovered that he was actually a Venusian, who was sent to take over the body of a human who had died at birth. And though he was married at the time of his contact with the aliens, they let him know that his soulmate had been reborn as a young lady in another town. So he divorced his wife and married his soulmate. Wrote an interesting book called From Outer Space to You. You don't know when you're dealing with this type of material, do the people that write it really mean what they say? Are they complete and total loons? Or is there some truth to what they say? Now, there have been many learned people down through history who have written things that kind of stagger the imagination. There's a story of Atlantis, for example. A mighty race of people who millennia ago held sway over entire regions of the planet. They were in many ways, according to the stories, far more advanced than our own civilization. Such was the level of renown that surrounded this ancient, majestic culture. In fact, they're even talked about at great length today. You could fill a library with books about them. For others, the entire matter is one that should be relegated to the world of folklore and mythology. In all likelihood, the truth can be found somewhere in the middle. Now, although countless words and books have been written on the rise and fall of Atlantis, everything is traced back to the work of Plato, the famed Greek philosopher who was born about 420 B.C. It was his work called Critias that introduced people to the world of Atlantis. He wrote about an unsuccessful attempt by the Atlanteans to invade and conquer the people of Athens. Now, although Critias has presented as fiction, many researchers into the Atlantis enigma of the opinion of Plato had acquired his information from archaic secret texts that told the truth of the astoundingly advanced society that existed long before our own. Now, according to the story, the ancient gods of Greece who may have been space aliens, and you pays your nickel and you take your chance, elected to apportion various parts of the planet to equally various gods. Atlantis' lord and master was Poseidon, the god of the sea. And like so many other gods that came before and after him, Poseidon lusted after humans, mortal women. One young woman in particular named Cleito demonstrated that the gods were actually flesh and blood as the rest of us. Poseidon and Cleito had a number of children, the first being a character by the name of Atlas. Man had a lengthy reign over Atlantis, eventually ceding rule to his firstborn. Now, according to Plato, for a long time, the relationship between the gods and the Atlanteans was a positive one. According to Critias, for many generations, and as long as the divine nature lasted in them, they were obedient to the laws and, well, affection toward the gods whose seed they were. They despised everything but virtue, caring little for their present state of life, thinking lightly of the possession of gold and other property, which seemed to be a burden. Neither were they intoxicated by luxury, nor did wealth deprive them of their self-control. They were sober, saw clearly that all the gods are increased by virtue and friendship with one another. Sadly, this state of harmony didn't last, as Plato recorded. When the divine portion began to fade away and became diluted too often and too much with the mortal admixture, and human nature got the upper hand, they then, being unable to bear their fortune, behaved unseemly. And to him had an eye to see grew visibly debased, for they were losing the fairest of their precious gifts. So a definitive wrath of God-style punishment followed, one which Atlantean cities fell. People died in multitudes, landscapes shifted, volcanoes spewed forth, and finally, this land of renown sank beneath the waves. But was the story of Atlantis just a story? Or could there have been a basis in reality? Such was the fascination of Plato's detailed and thought-provoking saga. Yet ensure that entire generations of Atlantis seekers sought to find the remains of the legendary land and its people. Plato's Critias clearly inspired Thomas More's Utopia, written in 1516, and Sir Francis Bacon's 1626 novel, The New Atlantis. Whereas neither More nor Bacon perceived Plato's work as being anything but fiction, others were of a much different view. One man who was largely responsible for bringing the story of Atlantis to a new and wide audience was 19th century writer and U.S. congressman from Minnesota, who also served as that state's lieutenant governor, Ignatius Donnelly. Unlike many elected officials, his time in Washington actually accomplished something. He wrote a book that's still in print. According to what he wrote in Atlantis, the Antediluvian World, the fact that the story of Atlantis was for thousands of years regarded as a fable proves nothing. There's an unbelief that grows out of ignorance, as well as the skepticism that's born of intelligence. The people nearest to the past are not always those who are best informed concerning that past. Well, in Donnelly's world, Atlantis was the inspiration for the biblical Garden of Eden and for Asgard, a Norse realm of the Scandinavian gods such as Thor and Loki. And as for its location, Donnelly suggested somewhere in the Mediterranean. Now, he also believed that the Atlanteans met a terrible and almost complete destruction. He also believed that survivors made their way to what's today Egypt and laid the foundations for that civilization that ultimately surfaced under the rule of the pharaohs. You know, the thing about Egypt that has puzzled so many, it seemed to begin at its height, and then civilization deteriorated. Now, like Plato, Donnelly talked about Atlantis being overwhelmed by gargantuan waves, something that had inspired, according to Donnelly, had inspired the tales of the Great Flood. Now, in turn, Donnelly's work caused other seekers of Atlantis to redouble their efforts to get to the truth, including James Bramwell, who wrote Lost Atlantis in 1938, Edgar Cayce, who in 1959 wrote Earth Changes, and Charles Berlitz, who wrote a book in 1969, The Mystery of Atlantis. Now, one problem more than any other has hindered the quest to solve the conundrum that is Atlantis. Where was it located? Now, many investigators of the Atlantis legend have followed the leads laid down by Plato and Donnelly by suggesting Atlantis was somewhere in the Atlantic Ocean or the Mediterranean Sea. Cyprus, Crete, Malta, Sardinia have all been offered as viable locations. Now, the Crete theory certainly has a bit going for it. History has demonstrated about 1500 BC, the Minoan culture on the island of Crete was nearly obliterated by a powerful tsunami and a volcanic eruption. Now, Crete's a good candidate, but there's one problem. The more that researchers, adventurers, authors, and scholars looked into the Atlantean tales, the more the time frame was pushed back and back and back again. In his 1969 book, Atlantis, The Truth Behind the Legend, Angelos Georgiou Galanopoulos suggested that the theories of Atlantis were distorted accounts of a cataclysm that occurred more than 9,000 years ago. It was a theory that took hold in the minds and opinions of many Atlantis seekers. The result, nearly 50 years later, the idea that Atlantis existed in the very remote past rather than the relatively recent past still has a lot of supporters. Now, Atlantis may have been swallowed up millennia upon millennia ago, and that's given rise to other theories for its final resting place. Rand and Rose Plymouth, the ones who wrote the book The Murder of Moses, also wrote a book called Atlantis Beneath the Ice, offering the theory that Atlantis was in reality what today we call Antarctica. And they said it was 9600 BC, which, of course, since it's 2019, we're looking at almost 12,000 years ago. And the list of potential sites for Atlantis doesn't end there. Turkey, North Africa, Ireland, the Canary Islands, India, the Andes, the vast South American mountain range have all been offered. But despite all the research and all the books and all the lectures, we're no closer to knowing the truth. In terms of the theory, the Atlanteans possessed astonishingly advanced technology that might very well have rivaled or even surpassed our own. It's necessary to focus on the work of a controversial man whose following is as devoted today as it was decades ago. Edgar Cayce, the sleeping prophet. A product of the latter part of the 19th century, Cayce, a prodigious author on all manner of esoteric topics, had a deep obsession with Atlantis and its people. And despite the fact he died in 1945, the final year of World War II, Cayce's words on Atlantis are still influencing today's seekers of that legendary land. Like Ignatius Donnelly, Cayce believed the remnants of the Atlantean society seeded what ultimately became the Egyptian Empire. Cayce's theories didn't come from in the field, archaeologically style probing. Quite the contrary, Casey asserted that he was nothing less than a reincarnated Egyptian priest by the name of Ra-Ta, who oversaw the running of a sacred Egyptian construction called the Temple of Sacrifice. While many of his skeptical nature dismissed his claims, there's one particularly notable story that does deserve telling. According to Casey, a vast hall of records that contained a full and unexpurgated story of the rise and fall of Atlantis existed in a chamber buried below the curved right paw of the Sphinx in Giza, Egypt. Well, decades later, Robert Schlock, a renowned Sphinx authority, found in his own words what he described as clear evidence of a cavity under the left paw of the Sphinx. Now, at that time, Schultz was unaware of Casey's assertions, assertions in the matter. So that makes things even more remarkable. And I remember reading very recently that there was evidence discovered that there is a chamber underneath the Sphinx. Now, in light of this, it might be wise to pay attention Edgar Casey's work, including his statements relative to what it was exactly that destroyed the Atlanteans. According to Casey, Atlantis was not a small island, as many assume, but a vast land that bordered upon the size of Europe. The Atlanteans, he said, were a highly advanced people possessed of fantastic crystals that provided a near unique power source that could be used to provide heat and electricity and could be used to heal numerous ailments and diseases. He also said as the years passed, the Atlanteans, once a proud and upstanding culture, became filled with what he called greed and lust and inadvertently destroyed themselves through a reckless use of their higher energy crystals. Can you say transistors? Well, the story is still not over. Casey predicted in either 1968 or 1969, Atlantis would finally rise from the waters and show itself to one and all. Well, it didn't quite happen like that. What did happen, September 1968, near Bimini Island in the Bahamas, something known as the Bimini Road was found. Shows all the signs of being a half-mile-long road, one that was intelligently constructed in the very distant past. And while arguments, counter-arguments, and counter-counter-arguments have been made with regard to whether or not the road is man-made or a curious product of Mother Nature, that it was discovered at the same time frame that Edgar Casey predicted evidence of Atlantis would be found, does raise interesting questions. They also found what appear to be buildings. It would be wise to consider the possibility that one day, tens of thousands of years from now, tales of our civilization might be perceived as nothing more than the ravings of lunatics born out of folklore and mythology. In fact, a perfect example of how this has happened in the world of fiction is the ending of the original Planet of the Apes, made in 1968 and starring Charlton Heston. Now, throughout the movie, Heston's character, an astronaut named Taylor, believes he's crash-landed on an insane world ruled by talking apes. It's only at the end of the Planet of the Apes that Taylor realizes he's traveled into the future, at a time when the human race is done, gone. Worldwide nuclear war was our downfall. How does he know? He finds the semi-buried remains of a shattered Statue of Liberty protruding out of the sands of a new battle-scarred landscape, what the apes called the Forbidden Zone. Well, maybe one day we'll find remnants of the Atlanteans. If we do, it's going to provide the stunning revelation we were not the first. That would be interesting. You know, one of the things that we've talked about or touched on in several of the shows is something called the Ark of the Covenant. Now, beyond a shadow of a doubt, the Ark of the Covenant was one of the most legendary and revered artifacts described in the pages of the Old Testament. It's also one of the most mysterious biblical artifacts as well. In fact, so mysterious is the Ark and the attendant story that surrounds it that a number of widely differing theories have been presented to try to explain both its origin and its purpose. Each and every one has one thing in common. They're all highly sensational and deeply inflammatory. There's a story that when the Ark was a two-way communication device, one that allowed the user to speak with none other than God himself, or as some researchers have concluded, with devious extraterrestrials posing as deities and whose sinister agenda was to manipulate and control the human race. Another scenario has the Ark as a powerful weapon, one designed to provoke deadly electric shocks in those who dared to get too close or meddle with it. And then there's the controversial possibility of the Ark being nothing more or less than radioactive. Other theorists suggest that the Ark had the power to transform sound itself into a deadly and devastating weapon of war. Yet there's so many wildly differing theories demonstrates only one thing for sure. Thousands of years after it first surfaced, the Ark of the Covenant remains the definitive and undeniable mystery that it was to so many of the ancients themselves. Now, we learned about the Ark in the pages of the Exodus, which is presented as a highly decorated chest. And there were many arks in Egypt. And as this says, it was a chest. It was designed to house the sacred stone tablets on which the Ten Commandments are written. Some biblical scholars believe that Mount Sinai is located in what today is Egypt's Sinai Peninsula. Others suggest somewhere in Saudi Arabia or in the region of the ancient city of Petra in the Kingdom of Jordan. But how did the Ark of the Covenant, that specific Ark, come to exist? You know, the answer is history doesn't tell us. Not for sure. We're solely relying upon ancient texts that have been written, rewritten, censored, and translated across thousands of years by multiple people with equally multiple agendas. The version accepted by those who adhere to the teaching of the Christian God is that around a year after the Israelites left Egypt and embarked upon what's become known as the Exodus, God provided Moses with the necessary information to construct the Ark, while the latter was at the base of Mount Sinai. It was a creation that instilled awe in those who encountered it. In others, it caused death, particularly so when they touched it. In a 2006 article entitled "Reengineering the Ark," written for 40 and Times magazine, researchers Michael Blackburn and Mark Bennett wrote that in verse 10 through 21 of Exodus, the instructions for the Ark are given. It's a lidless rectangular box construction made of shittim wood, measuring 2.5 cubits long by 1.5 cubits wide and high. It's covered in gold over the inner and outer surfaces with a gold crown or border around the top. 4 gold rings are then added to each corner with the carrying poles, and those are to be made of the same gold-covered wood, and it's specifically ordered they should never be removed. Now, given that the Ark of the Covenant was essentially a box, how is it possible that, as the Old Testament states, it apparently played a major role in the legendary parting of the Red Sea, something that allowed the fleeing Israelites to escape the clutches of the pursuing Egyptian army? And how, according to the Old Testament, was the Ark able to provide the catastrophic fall of the walls of Jericho when the Israelites began their conquest of Canaan? Well, the answer is simple. The Ark wasn't just a box or a chest. It was a great deal more. But the walls of Jericho were reportedly brought down in part as a result of the presence of the Ark, and that the waters of the Red Sea were directly parted by the mysterious powers of the Ark has led to an amazing and thought-provoking theory. This one assumes the ancients possessed a long-forgotten and now lost technology. a technology based around the manipulation of acoustics, possibly to near effortlessly move through the air the massive stones that were used in the construction of the pyramids. The similar pyramids of South America and England's famous Stonehenge. Now, that technology is still very much at a theoretical level in today's world, known as acoustic levitation. Now, in a 2009 book, The Resonance Key, investigators Marie Jones, and I know her, and Larry Flaxman described acoustic levitation as a means to introduce two opposing sound frequencies with interfering sound waves, which create a resonant zone that allows the levitation to occur. Theoretically, to move a levitating object, simply change or alter the two sound waves and tweak accordingly. Now, in this process, it would also be theoretically feasible to use such sound waves as a sonic weapon, such as flattening the walls of a city, such as Jericho, or the means to manipulate and alter the flow of water at the Red Sea. Now, the idea that the Ark of the Covenant was an acoustic weapon of deadly proportions is an interesting idea. It's an idea that has a number of rivals that are all eagerly vying for the top spot. According to Paul Schroeder, an Ark investigator, in an article he wrote in 2010, "I've never bashed the Bible for its accuracy or inaccuracy, but only for its legitimacy as God's word." He takes the view that it was ancient aliens rather than an ancient God that engineered the Ark of the Covenant. There's overwhelming biblical evidence that the Ark of the Covenant was structurally designed to act as both an alien transmitter, capacitor, and a weapon. The Ark, lethal if touched, was used to communicate with aliens posing as God, and it aided Israelites when it was carried into battle. He ended his article by saying this machine or weapon is a technological artifice, an alien-designed three-in-one communications device, religious receptacle, and weapon of mass destruction. There's also the story that in one battle, supposedly an army that carried the Ark before it couldn't lose, but in one battle the Israelites did. The Egyptians took it. They put it in their temple. And the next day, all the statues were laying face down. Those who touched the Ark died. An illness broke out. So they took it back out to the battlefield, put it in a wagon pulled by animals, and sent it back toward the Israelites. Well, we've come to the end of tonight's show, and I'll be talking more about this tomorrow. So until then, show saying have a truly great evening.